Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hey, I'm Dan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dan.
Yeah, grateful to be here. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Cool. All right. This is weird. So I'm going to do a quick brief 10-minute what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now with you guys. So, yeah, I like to just explain how alcoholism, what that means for me, what it means for me to be an alcoholic, just to kind of ground myself in AA as much as possible. And for me, being an alcoholic means, like, I have the phenomenon of craving, so when I start drinking, I don't know when I'm going to stop. I don't know how that's going to end. And I have alcoholism, which manifests in my mind, and which convinces me essentially over and over to take another drink. I have the obsession of the mind that in the face of all consequences, it's always going to be a good idea to drink again. Like, I will always figure out a way to make drinking a good idea, no matter what I'm faced with. And I've proven that time and time again. And that will happen if I don't treat my alcoholism and come to AA and get out of this self-centeredness and get out of kind of this obsession with myself and what I'm going to get and how to make myself feel better, you know? And because eventually what I've experienced is that wanting to make myself feel better eventually is drinking, you know, for me as an alcoholic. So, yeah, my story, to keep it really brief because it's short, a little share here. I started drinking when I was about 12 and loved it right away. And then at about like 19 years old, came to AA and got a year of sobriety with AA in Seattle, where I was living at the time, and then commenced to relapse. And I hadn't worked the 12 step that time. I had done a lot of 9-step amends and I had done work in AA, but I relapsed. And I still wanted to drink, you know, and so I drank. And then I came back to AA and got 9 years through most of my 20s, about 9 years of sobriety. And did AA for a portion of that and was into it. And at some point, again, decided to drink again, you know. And I guess, like, that stuff in my story is important for me to remember because I know that I'm not fixed. And I know that I know that I'm not, like, ever going to, you know, have done enough AA to be sober forever. Like, and that's okay with me, you know, like, that's like the good news in a way. It's like, it gives me a reason to be here and to show up. And so this time around, this last relapse got really bad, really dark. I started ending up in hospitals a lot as directly resulting from drinking alcohol. And, you know, there was like a little bit of jail in there and there was a psych ward stint because I wanted to kill myself. And, you know, none of that was bad enough to stop me from wanting to drink, though. Like, at the end of that, I was, like, in an SLE in San Francisco trying to drink still. Like, I still wanted to go party. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, I'm, like, I'm living in an SLE, but, like, if I have 20 bucks, I'm going to go party tonight. Like, let's go hit the bar from the SLE, you know? And, like, that's the way that I drink. And, you know, like, eventually there was just like a little like gap, like a little period, because I like couldn't stop drinking, where someone kind of said, like, you need to just like hold it together, dude. You know what I mean? You need to just like not drink for 10 days. Like, I don't care what that looks like. Like, grab a sponsor and don't drink for 10 days and live in your sober house. And I did that. And then like things started to clear up enough for me to be able to like digest what's going on in AA and to stay sober for a period of time for like 30 days, you know, and then like 60 days and 90 days. And, But like what really happened, and this wasn't the first time in my life that this had happened, like my other sobrieties, there were times where I did this. What really happened was I started being honest about what was going on with me. You know, like I started saying, like, I want to drink. Like, I don't know how to do this. Like, I started just like telling the truth. And so that kind of like started this new path in sobriety. And it's been different. You know, I've like shined light on some things that I didn't in the past, and learned how to take care of myself a lot better than I ever have in my whole life, you know? And, 5 minutes. 5 minutes. Yeah. So, you know, and so like some changes have happened this time around that I like see now, like that didn't take place in my other sobriety. And, it's just like some kind of basic fundamental stuff that, has helped me with my self-esteem and like how I feel about myself, you know? And it's just like basic being able to like take care of business, like being able to like pay the bills and like shower and like, you know what I mean? Like live a relatively normal life, like eat breakfast, like show up at my job on time for the most part, you know? but like that was stuff I didn't know how to do like when I got here. And I didn't know how to live, you know what I mean? I just knew how to drink, really, and, like, try to kind of float by and find people to, like, help me live, you know? And so I've been, like, you know, so I kind of worked closely. I'm, like, a big proponent of sponsorship, by the way, and I worked really closely with my sponsor and got really honest and, you know, did a really thorough fifth step with him, fourth and fifth step. And, you know, and like had a spiritual experience that, allowed me to feel safe, like being sober, but still, like safe in general, you know, like I started having this experience of like, oh, I feel safe in my sobriety. Like things are going to be okay. And, that was something like I hadn't experienced in that way before. And, so I continue working through the steps. And now I'm like working with others, and I'm pretty much done with my ninth step. And I guess I'll share about this. I share about this sometimes. I had this cool nine step experience where I had to make amends with Trader Joe's for ripping off a bottle of whiskey. Like I stole a bottle of Maker's Mark from this Trader Joe's in San Francisco. And I don't know why I kind of wanted to make this amends. Like, I mean, I didn't like, and in the moment before I walked into it, I was like, this is crazy. Like, I'm going to have to grab this dude, like this like manager guy and be like, hey man, like I stole from you, you know? And, so like, as I was going into it was when the fear hit. Beforehand, I was just like, this just sounds like a crazy story. Like this doesn't even seem like something real kind of, so I can't even really like be scared, you know? But then I went into it and it was like the fear kind of came up, and then I like got this guy who works there and he was like cool, you know, like he was like cool, but he was like cool with me being sober and like what I was doing and that I was like had the money. I looked at the bottle that I stole, like it was the same one and had the like had double the amount. That's what my sponsor wanted me to do. And he was just like stoked that I was sober. And I think that like, it was that I had no expectations going into that, you know? And I think like, that's kind of, that's not really the, like, that hasn't been my experience in the amends. Like a lot of times I feel like it's going to be a certain way, or like this person's going to be back in my life in a certain way, or there's some kind of like expectation with a lot of them, you know, and I do them anyway. But with this one, it was like, I was just like, this is just going to be stupid. Like, I don't know what this is going to be and I don't care, you know? And, I've found that like, or not even this is, I just had no judgment about it. I had no idea what it was going to be about. And, you know, and I had this great, really beautiful experience with that, where this guy was like, you know, like this guy was like cool with what I was doing. And, I think that, I don't know, I guess I learned a lesson there, because it's like, if I just kind of like lived my life that way, like if I went into situations that way, you know, I'd be open to a lot more of a positive experience. So anyway, grateful to be here, and it's nice to share with you guys. Thanks.
And now I'd like to turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Amy.
Okay. This thing working? Yes, it sounds like it. Okay. I'm Amy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Amy.
So, I was willing to let Dan go the whole time. Anybody else want to go with him? So, when I was younger, as a child, I thought that alcoholics looked a certain way. I thought they were generally homeless. They all seemed to wear trench coats for some reason. I don't know, that was just part of the image. They lived in the gutter. I didn't even know what that meant exactly, but there were these big gutters that all these people slept in, and they had hallucinations all the time. They were like batting birds out of their things, right? So they were completely insane. And I thought, oh, I don't want anything to do with that. And my mother's... Both my parents were relatively sober, but my mother's father was an alcoholic, and she would tell me, you know, that it was horrible growing up with an alcoholic, and that he would forget who she was all the time, and how much damage he did to their family, and how she hated him, and when he died, she didn't cry. So this is my image of an alcoholic. It's something I definitely do not want to be. So surprise, when I had my first drink, and I was like, oh, this is what it's like to be drunk? This is cool. I didn't even understand, like, where that impression what came from. This idea that alcoholism was going to be this horrible thing, and I was going to have hallucinations. I was like, well, I'm not having hallucinations. I feel really good. And so immediately, from the very first time I drank, I noticed what it did for my image. Like, all of a sudden, I felt very interesting, funny, smart. I felt much wittier than I normally do. And it really made me feel connected to other people. So growing up, before I had that first drink, I was one of the nerds. And I didn't have a lot of friends, and I wasn't very popular. And it was really easy to see the way in to the social cool people was going to be alcohol. That was going to be it. And I just was going around everywhere telling people, I drink. By the way, I drink. And I thought, this is the most fantastic tool I've ever had to get friends fast, because all the people that drank were like, yeah, let's go drink together. It's the easiest thing ever. I'm like, this is like so easy to make friends. I had no idea. You know, so I started drinking around the age of 13, and we would go to this place called the White Palace in Wheeling, West Virginia. And so in West Virginia, there's not a lot to do, but it's pretty easy to buy alcohol underage. There was a place called Papa K's and the Swing Club. You could get into them. You could buy beer takeout at Papa K's. It was drive through, and they didn't card anybody. It was awesome. And that's what we did, a lot of drinking and driving, because that's like what a proud alcoholic does. I mean, there wasn't a lot to do in Wheeling, so we just drove around and drank, and we'd throw our beer cans right out the window into the beautiful, wild, wonderful, beautiful West Virginia. My father taught at a small, small Jesuit university that I promise you, probably nobody in here has heard of before, called Wheeling College. And it was like literally 700 students, this little Jesuit college in Wheeling, West Virginia. So I went to that college campus to party when I was in high school. And of course, because my dad like teaches there, so I could bring that up when I'm drinking. My dad teaches here. Oh, and everybody wanted to get, you know, the professors, everybody knew my dad, so everybody wanted to get me drunk. It was awesome. You know, so I was like the superstar. But I embarrassed my dad a few times, because I would go to these parties that they would have, and a lot of times the faculty and the staff and the president of the college would be there. and the president was a priest, because it's Jesuit college, so it's Father Acker. I fell on Father Acker during one of these parties, and it got back to my dad, which I didn't realize until, like, several months later, when he finally calmed down enough to talk to me about it and how I had embarrassed him. So I already started blacking out in high school and thought that was just the most fascinating thing ever. And so in college, that was like my favorite thing to do, was like drink until I black out. And then everybody would tell me stories about how funny I was the next day. This is great, you know. I just thought this was this magical thing. You know, I disappear and I get really funny when I'm in a blackout. And I could imagine that I was so interesting and entertaining when I was blackout drunk, right? And I would meet people sober and they'd say, yeah, I met you last night. And I'd be like, well, I don't remember that. And I thought that was hilarious. You know, my parents spent a lot of money for me to go to college. And it really is sad thinking about it now that I really spent 4 years of just blacking out. And I spent all night partying and then all day sleeping. Notice there was no period of time where I was actually going to class. There was a lot of lies, a lot of excuses about mononucleosis and a variety of other psychological issues that I had, why I couldn't take the test right now or why I need an extension. I was always really good at selling my teachers on, I'm a salesperson now, so I was very good at selling people on the fact that I should be given a little more time to finish my classes because I'm really sick or from something, alcohol poisoning. but anyway, I remember in college when I would have an exam the next day, I would pull an all-nighter because I hadn't been to class, and I had to find somebody that went to class, pay them for their notes, and then either pay them to cheat off of them, or I'd be pulling the all-nighter, and that would be when I would practice my controlled drinking because I have to study, so I'm just going to drink a couple beers all night long while I'm, you know, I'd space them out. Like, I can only have one beer every 2 hours if I'm going to be up all night studying for this exam the next day. And a lot of times I would get to that final half hour and I'd be like, fuck it, I'm not going. You know, so that was college. That was great. I did meet somebody in AA in college, and she came to my room one day and she told me all about being in AA. And I realize now that she was trying to 12-step me. But at the time I was like, you poor girl. That's so horrible for you. I'm so sad. You know, and I was like tiptoeing around her like, she's an alcoholic. Shh, don't let her know how much fun we're having. She can't drink. She's got that whole hallucination, going to be in the gutter thing happening to her. And had no idea that what I was doing, blacking out, actually qualifies as, you know, drinking too much. The way I drank in college was I would throw up purposefully, very quickly. You know, like I'd down like 6 beers really fast and then I'd go puke so I could drink some more. Because my image was that I could drink you under the table, but I've always been fairly small and I really couldn't drink as much as the people I was drinking with, but I wanted to pretend I could, so I was always hiding how much I was puking, you know. But I would stick with it, you know. I had real determination. I was going to stay there with the rest of the alcoholics and drink all night long. And my favorite place to be was a fraternity that was known as the alcoholic fraternity. I'm like, yes, we know we're alcoholics. This is great. We all admitted we were alcoholics all the time while we were drinking at this fraternity. Another fun story from college. On spring break, I went to New Orleans, Bourbon Street. Lots of rum there, and got alcohol poisoning on Bourbon Street. And my roommate and I had driven down together, and we were sharing this drive. And we had to be back the next day for class. It was like a 19-hour drive, and I was in college in Pennsylvania. And so I get alcohol poisoning on the last day, and I'm like, I threw up all over Bourbon Street. I was horrendously sick, and then she had to drive the entire way back, and every like half hour she had to pull over so I could throw up, not throw up in her car. And so that was that was fun. You know, like at least I waited for the last day to get, you know, really get into the alcohol poisoning. But I continued vomiting for like 2 days straight. It was not good. Projectile vomiting. Good stuff. But that's not my bottom, by the way. I keep going, you know, like... So I went to graduate school. I don't know how I graduated because I was in danger of failing every single semester. And somehow I would pull it out at the end. Okay, I do know how. I cheated a lot. That's right. yeah, I don't know how to make amends for that one. I haven't yet. So you can talk to me about that later. When I got out of college, I went to graduate school, went to North Carolina for graduate school. And I realized once I got to that level that other people were not as social as me. And they weren't partying as much as I wanted to. And this whole graduate school thing was getting in the way of me partying. So I decided I was going to go become a career waitress instead, because that was just as good as getting a PhD, right? I mean, I had found the thing that I really wanted to do. I decided to work at a restaurant where it's not just a bunch of college students working there, because I did that at first, and I was like, no, I'm really serious about my career in waitressing, right? So I don't want to just work with a bunch of college students who are just doing it for their summer break. I want to do it with people who are really serious about waiting tables. So I went to a restaurant where there were career waits, and that was where I felt much more comfortable. Now, somewhere along the road, a lot of drugs end up in this mix as well. And I did pretty much everything under the sun. When I did my intake at a rehab program years later, they asked me what I did. And I surprised myself as I was going through the list. I was like, wow, it's like a dictionary of the drugs that are out there. But the one that really... kind of brought me to my knees was crack cocaine. And those are my bottoms. Well, no, wait. I've got several alcoholic bottoms for you, too, since we're here at AA. One of my bottoms, of many, So in college, I spent a semester in France, and I fell in love with the bartender, because that's what you do when you're an alcoholic. That's the person who has the alcohol, so I'm like staring at him all the time, and all of a sudden I'm beer goggling, and he's just so beautiful, the bartender, oh my God. I'm in love with this French bartender named Denis, and so I get out of college, and I'm in graduate school, and he writes to me and says he's going to come to the United States to visit, and says, I'll come visit you, and I'm like, that's awesome. And I'm like, this is it. I'm going to convince him to move to the United States. This is the love of my life. And he's going to be here for a little while, and he's kind of feeling it out. He might move here. This is so great. And I meet him, and we go whitewater rafting. I instead of it being like a fun time with just me and him and me actually showing him something of the country, it becomes me showing him like 20 of my alcoholic friends, and then we're all going to go whitewater rafting and be inside this house just drinking the entire time. Like, he got zero tour of anything because we just got plastered the entire time. And I thought that was like really showing him a good time, because we really drank a lot of alcohol those 2 days. And so I blacked out for most of it, so I don't even remember what happened. And I came out of the blackout in the middle of whitewater rafting, and he's not speaking English to me right now. He's pissed off. He's just like, stupid American. And he's like going off in French with all these words, like, I don't even remember them anymore. Petit con. Like, all these words that are not very nice. And I don't even know what I've done, because I don't remember anything until that very moment when he's yelling at me. And so, but I also realized within a few minutes of coming out of the blackout that I had somehow broken two of my teeth. And I still to this day do not know how that happened, except that the next night when I was drinking again and I was holding my bottle of Absolute Citron that I was going to finish all by myself, I hit myself in the teeth when I was getting drunk, and I was like, oh, it's kind of the same shape as this bottle. So I think that's what happened. But it's kind of amazing that I would hit myself in the teeth so hard with a bottle that I actually broke my teeth. But, I mean, that's the theory that I'm going with. That's what I think happened. But that was, you know, that was a bottom that also did not stop me from quitting. The actual night that I is my the day before my sobriety date, which is October 20th, 2001, was I was smoking crack, and it was so bad, and I had isolated myself so badly that I also worked as an EMT at the time, and I was obsessed with having a heart attack. I was like, because we had picked up a lot of people on the ambulance that had also had heart attacks, and we were always picking up people who were in their 30s who had stroked out, and I was really nervous about smoking crack, but I was going to smoke crack anyway. So my safety protocol was I would take my pulse, and as soon as my pulse dropped below 180, I would take another hit. But before taking a hit, I had this like cordless cell phone that I would dial 911, put the phone right next to me, take the hit, and then hold my hand with my finger over the one button just in case I had a heart attack. I mean, that's so sad. I was all by myself, like, and worried I was going to have a heart attack. Well, accidentally, once I hit the one button, and I had been fired as an EMT, maybe because of, like, the fact that I was really irresponsible and slept through my shifts and complained about everything, and I was super weak because I was smoking crack all the time. I don't know. The combination was just, you know, something like that, but I got fired. And when you accidentally dial 911, you can't tell them, never mind. They come anyway. So, and I said, oh, I'm smoking some crack, but I think I'm okay. And they're like, you don't want us to send an ambulance? I said, no, it's okay, really, it's okay. No, fucking fire truck showed up, ambulance showed up, and I lived at this little house. It was like 7-acre yard, and like, it's this huge, long driveway, and like, they're all coming down the big, long driveway. And it's the freaking ambulance team that I just worked with, and the woman who just fired me, okay? So if it wasn't obvious before that I was a crackhead, it was, you know, now it was really obvious. And she said, you know, you got to call somebody and get them over here. I refused the ambulance ride, and they made me call my list because I had been coming to meetings. That's another part of the story that we're going to get into here. I spent about 4 years of relapsing where I couldn't get sober, but on that particular day, she said, go through your list and call somebody until you get a hold of somebody. And I called a whole bunch of people and left a bunch of messages, and nobody answered. So, you know, those lists that you get when you're a newcomer and they say get a bunch of names, and you think, well, I've already got 5, 10, 15, I had like 25 names. Not one single person answered that phone. And they're like, all the EMTs are standing around me, well, call somebody else. And they're just making me call and call. And finally they were like, I was like, I'm fine. I swear I'm fine. And I somehow talked them into leaving. And then one of my friends calls me back and she says, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm looking through my CDs and I was going to sell some more CDs so I can go smoke some more crack. And she said, no, you're going to detox. And I was like, no, I don't think you heard what I said. I'm actually going to go smoke some more crack because I wasn't a heart attack and I'm still ready to go. But somehow she convinced me that she was coming over, and she came over, not just her, she came over with her big brother and one of my other friends who, like, totally, I was so embarrassed that she brought this other friend too, and that she saw me like at my bottom. So the three of them came over and dragged me off to detox. So that was October 19th, 2001. So October 20th is my sobriety date. That day with the ambulance actually comes after 4 years of relapsing. In 1997, I started working at Duke Hospital because I had gone to graduate school at Duke, and I thought, okay, well, I went to Duke, so I get priority over these other people. I got a job at the hospital somehow, doing clinical research, and I knew I had a problem with drugs and alcohol, and I just was waiting till the 90-day mark hit so that I could go to the employee assistance program. So the employee assistance program, I walk, you know, 90 on day 90, I walk through that door and I'm like, okay, I need to stop smoking crack and my life is totally unmanageable. And she says, and I'm thinking that we're going to schedule maybe like two or three more sessions and she's going to tell me something or give me something that's going to get me off the crack. And she says, you need to go to rehab. I was like, really? And that's what they tell you when you tell them that you have a crack problem. They say the employee assistance program is not the appropriate venue for this. So I started going to an intensive outpatient. So I was going there every night after work. I would go to my intensive outpatient. And I was supposed to be going to meetings, but most of the time I was fudging signatures and not going and lying about it and buying weed for the other young kids that are in the addictions program with me. And I was really popular because I was supplying everybody with drugs and alcohol. I was not doing a very good job at this rehab. But when I finally started coming to meetings, you know, I thought I could figure out what people were saying in here. And then I could like figure out my own program. But every time I came in here, it's like, I just knew I was different. I knew that this isn't going to work for me. I'm going to have to do it a different way. And, you know, I finally had a sponsor that used the term terminally unique. And that really hit me because I realized that I was coming in here and everybody I listened to, I either put them above me or below me. And one of the readings in the big book, it says, I wrote this down here. Always we tried to struggle to the top of the heap or to hide underneath it. That is it on, actually it's in the 12 and 12, page 53. Anyway, so that's what I did when I got here. I either wanted to be above everybody or below them. And it would kind of depend upon if I was feeling like a wave of mania and I felt very grandiose and like I could fly and I felt really cool, or if I came in here and I was feeling defeated. In those days, you could tell when I was feeling like I wanted to be underneath the heap because I would kind of cross my arms and my legs and like kind of make myself this little tiny ball in my chair and I wouldn't look at anybody and I would just kind of hide. I try to like make myself invisible, right? Superpower invisible, activate. And so there was always, somehow I didn't relate to people. Like I was different. I was, you know, like I'm actually crazy. Like the other people in here are just alcoholics, but I'm actually like an autistic, like a misunderstood genius. That's what I am. I'm a misunderstood genius and nobody is understanding this. Like how, I can't relate to these people. So looking at the ways that I've made myself different and isolated myself from everybody else was what eventually sunk in and I had a real surrender. So it took 4 years of relapsing and going in and out and in and out and thinking I was going to find a different way. And I do feel like there is sort of two levels to the first step. There's one where you recognize that you're an alcoholic and that you have a problem. And I intermittently got that one. But what I did not accept was that this was the solution, because I thought I could come up with a much better solution than this. This looks ridiculous. Come on. It doesn't look like that's going to work at all. And I had the contempt prior to investigation, for sure. So when I finally did surrender, people had been telling me, I had counselors at Duke Addictions Program who had been telling me that I needed to be in a sober living environment. And they'd been telling me that from 1997 on. And finally, October 2001, after that relapse, a friend of mine who lived in an Oxford house or sober living environment called me and said, we have a space for you in the house. And I moved into that house, and that was the support that I really needed. But I had to surrender and get to the point where I realized I have to throw everything at this. I have to go after this. And I have to own my own recovery. Not long after being in the Oxford house, People rotated in and out of that place so fast, it was ridiculous. So within like 3 months, I was the president of the house. And when I started, I was looking at the president and all the people in the house as like these authority figures. Like they represent what I'm rebelling against. Just like I represent what you're rebelling against, right? So like these are the people that know, that have their lives together, that have their shit together, and I hate them. Because they have their shit together, and I'm never going to be able to get my shit together because I'm, like, inherently irresponsible, and I'm inherently crazy. Like, I cannot do this program. There's no way I can do this program. So when I got to that point, 3 months into living at the house, and everyone's all of a sudden rebelling against me, I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. I am not the program. And it's like the illusion that there was some person or like governing body that was running the program of AA all crumbled. I was like, oh my God, nobody is running this place. Holy shit, I have to do this myself. Like, there's not somebody going to save me. And I really wanted somebody to save me. And in fact, the 4 years that I was floundering around, I had sponsors. It's their fault that I relapsed. I was blaming them every time I relapsed, you know, like that. That's what my relationship with my sponsor was. I would go, like, stay at her house. She would feed me. And then if, like, if she said, you know, I really kind of want to have dinner with my family, you should go. I would go relapse, and I would blame her. You know, like, well, it's because I wasn't living in your living room. So I found that that was really powerful to own my own recovery. And I realized that when I decided that it doesn't matter who it is, that I have to own my recovery for myself, and no matter who actually believes and agrees with AA, because when I first got in here, I wanted to convince everybody, like my brother and my mother and my college friends and my roommates and the people that I partied with, I had tried to convince them, like, AA is this really amazing thing, and they do this. And then if they said, I think that's stupid and you're getting brainwashed, I'd be like, oh, yeah, you're right, totally. And I didn't want to own it. Like, I wanted everybody to agree this is the path that I should take. But I realized, thank you, I realized that I had to make this decision, and whether or not anybody else agreed with me, if I decide I'm in AA, then it's my decision. And even if, like, the coolest friend I have and all of her gorgeous, cool friends and all the artists and the boyfriend, the narcissistic boyfriend that broke my heart, if they all say, oh, my God, that AA thing is for total losers, it doesn't matter. I own this. This is what I'm going to do, even if everybody else decides this is a stupid thing to do. This is what I want to do. So I had to have some ownership of my recovery. So I've got 10 more minutes to do a quick run through of the steps and how I've worked them in my life. Step one, as you can imagine, the powerlessness of some of the bottoms that I described to you and that utter defeat is what made me understand powerlessness. Alcoholics try to control the things we can't control, and then don't want to control the things we can. It's quite funny. So we have a very interesting, like, relationship to power and what we have power over. We just become obsessed with having power over the one damn thing we can't have power over. So, you know, I had this belief that I am irresponsible and I can't handle responsibility. So powerlessness was like, oh, good. Okay, well, I don't have to be responsible. So then we move into step two. And step two, in the book it talks about they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. And we really do get insane when we come in here. We really think that we can control something we can't control. We think that we're going to do the same thing and it's going to turn out differently. I kept using and drinking and thinking that somehow I was going to do it successfully, or I was going to come into these rooms and figure out a way to drink and use successfully. And that kind of insanity is just literally, you cannot tell the true from the false. And so it was nice to come in here and realize that there are people getting sober and to see the people's lives changing. So that it was like the proof is in the pudding. I saw it happening. In step three, step three is where you really commit. You make the decision that you're going to get into action. So for me, I remember my sponsor saying to me, if you want what we have, you do what we did. Not, it doesn't say, if you want what we have, go ahead and keep doing what the hell you're doing and just do whatever the hell you want to do, and then you'll get our results. That is not, the tool is, if you want what we have, you'll do what we did. And so, but I didn't want to do what they did. I wanted to do it my way. So step three was turning my will over. And a big part of that was turning my will over to doing the steps of AA. And recognizing that I have this ego path, this fantasy world that I'm going to get rich and famous and have all this success and have a big house and beautiful husband. And like I have this, had this ego path, which I thought was what my life was all about. Turns out when I get into AA that I'm on a spiritual path now, and that my life is about spiritual learning and spiritual growth and reconnecting to my higher power, conscious contact with a higher power. That has reordered my entire life. That is the direction that my life is going in now. And that's because of the ball that I started rolling in step three, which is making that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And God doesn't, I mean, God isn't like trying to take away the house and the fortune and the success and the husband and all that stuff. But if there's a spiritual growth that's more important than, it's more important than those things. And I will tell you that all those goals that I had my whole life until recovery, which was, you know, all the goals that commercials tell us that we're supposed to have in our lives, like I have a lot of those things, but they are not that important to me. They're not what makes me so happy to be here today and so happy to be alive. It's the change that I've had internally and how good I feel in my own skin. It's the ability to like really love myself and accept myself. In step four, we do our inventory. Thank you. And an important part of the inventory is resentments. And an interesting thing about expectations is that they lead to resentments. Expectations are future resentments. The word resentment is actually from the Latin word sentir being to feel. So when you look at your fourth step that way and you look at what am I still feeling in my life? What are the conversations that I'm still playing? And that person, we haven't had that conversation in 15 years, but I'm still like upset about it. Or a situation that I walked in on or something that I did that I'm still like making up lies and excuses for why I did it in my head. I'm still feeling some action that I did. So that kind of guided my step four to think about the places where I feel that. Now, step four, when I got to step four, I was like, oh, good. We're going to do an inventory, and I'm going to find all the things that are wrong with me, and then I'm going to fix them all, and then I'm going to be perfect, and people are really, really going to like me, and I'm going to really have a lot of power. This is going to be great. But you get along in the steps, and it says we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and surprise, there's no place where it says, and then God removed all of those defects of character and you became perfect. That actually is not one of the steps, unfortunately. So I realized that there's something different that happens in steps 4, 5, and 6. It's a perception change. We change how we see who we are and we come to accept who we are. So that shift in perception is so important to us. My sponsor always says this program is a disease of perception. It's not a program of self-improvement. It's a program of self-acceptance. So I just want to end with a little something from step 11. The 11th step prayer is one of my favorite prayers. It's the may I understand rather than be understood, may I love rather than be loved, that fun prayer, the St. Francis prayer. And he uses this term self-forgetting in that prayer, which didn't make any sense to me for the longest time in AA. But along the course of my spiritual path, I have realized that all these forms of self and the stories that we tell about who we are and how important I am and this the direction that my ego says I'm going and how famous and cool and successful and interesting I am, that image that I put on from the very first time I took a drink, I realized that that self, as soon as I can forget about that self, I can be happy. And you really are born to eternal life by self-forgetting. So if you're stuck in self-pity, if you're stuck in a story about how horrible your life is and how you're so different and you're in so much pain and no one, you're never going to get this worked out because you've got all these unique issues, just forget yourself. Focus on the present moment. Focus on what's arising in front of you. There's all these blessings that we're sober right here, right now, together. And there's a moment for you to be without remembering the self, just to focus on right here, right now. And that's also a really good place to be when you're working with others and doing service, which is gets you into step 12, which is advanced AA. That'll have to be my next talk.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.